Hi there, I'm Mark McGrinder. I was in a season performing in two shows, Peter Pan and The Mystery of Edwin Drood. I was in Toronto for what was the final round of Lion King auditions. It was the Toronto production. I think it was going into this, it's like first replacement cast. And so I had been on this sort of merry-go-round of like audition prep with these like puppets, and I was auditioning for the role of Timon, which was amazingly played by Jonathan Wilson in the original Toronto production. So it had been like weeks of, you know, songs going in, working stuff, doing these puppets, and that morning was my callback for the New York producers and Stephanie Gorin. My audition was around 9, I think it was about 9 o'clock. And I wanted to prepare, and it was down at the Walter Carson Center, down by the water. So I thought, I'm gonna go down really early, gorgeous, gorgeous day, and just started walking around by the water, just outside, sort of, you know, to myself, doing my like, Hakuna Matata, what a wonderful phrase, you know, and looking like a lunatic to all around me. And you know, it was a weird thing because I'm not a musical theater performer. I've done them. I do like character things. So I was incredibly, incredibly nervous going into this, what was like totally like the most important audition of my life. You know, felt like that, this major gig. So I go and I get there and I kind of wait and I go in and this room of people, like many, many people I don't know at a table, no one looks up at me, and I'm just like, hi, and I'm my heart is already racing because I have to sing, I have to do this stuff, and they were talking, they were on cell phones, they kind of looked up, and someone said, get in the puppet, like, we'll be with you in a minute, and I was like, okay, like, nice to see you too, so I went and got into the puppet, which I was technically too tall for, but I lied and said I was 5'7", yeah, got in that and kind of, you know, ambled over to the thing, and they weren't looking, and they were talking, and they were on the phone, and then someone, it might have been Stephanie, but someone said, sorry, we're just having trouble with our flights back home. I was like, perhaps you could find another time to deal with that, you know, I thought. And then I kind of got one of these, you know, like a sort of like, go ahead, we'll keep talking. And that's not uncommon, right, for people to not totally pay attention to you. But I totally had like a panic attack. I don't remember anything about my audition except that I'm sure I was terrible because I could barely breathe because no one's paying attention to me. They're talking and I finished it and they're like, that's great. Thanks. Bye. And I left. And I remember coming out and Patrick Brown was there. He was at Shaw with me that season as well. And he was auditioning for Scar, which he, I think, eventually ended up playing on Broadway. And I came out and he said, how was it? And I said, it was awful. Like nobody looked at me. Nobody listened to me. And like, I did so much work on this thing. And he said, well, maybe it has something to do with the fact that a plane flew into the World Trade Center. And I was like, what? Like, seriously? And he said, yeah. And I said, oh my God. And I don't even know why this was my first instinct, but I remember saying, was it an accident? And he said, well, I don't think so, because 20 minutes later, another one flew into the other tower. And I was just like, oh my God. And then, you know, first of all, like, you know, I have friends, I have people there. Is this the start of the end? Is this just like a weird, like I had no idea. I didn't have a phone that I could check things on social media. And then also my tendency is to suddenly feel really bad for all my negative thoughts towards the panel. You know, I'm like, what? Oh, no wonder like awful things are happening. And I remember like, I have to get back for two shows today at Shaw. I don't even know if they're gonna do it. And so I walked out, Walter Carson down by the water, and this guy's on his boat, sat with him for a little bit. I said, can I just listen. He had the radio on. Just listen for a bit.
Did you see what happened? What happened?
Well, I was in the PATH train, and there was a huge explosion sound. Everyone came out. A large section of the building is blown out around, like, the 80th floor.
Was it hit by some?
Just sort of silent, sort of communing with a person, again, before phones. So, like, you know, an actual moment of human connection. And I just sat there for a few minutes, listened, sort of shaking my head, like trying to understand it. Of course, sitting on the water, looking right up at the CN Tower, just thinking, you know, is that next? Again, no context, and then realized, yeah, I gotta get to Shaw. I gotta do Peter Pan at 2:00. I gotta go to Neverland.
Hi, I'm Michael Healy. This is Just One More. I don't have too much to say about today's episode. You can all see what it is, where it's going. And there has been a lot said and written over the last 20 years or so about art's usefulness in a crisis and how art can make us cohere in ways that are particularly useful when things are chaotic, so you don't need more of that from me today. And of course, the shadow of that truth, that a piece of art that's potent enough and that captures enough of us can actually obscure the world as it is, you know, which is a real problem. That's also been repeated to the point where it's practically a cliche. But right now, Mark McGrinder is just trying to get through that day. Here's Mark.
I hop in the car, and my driving station was always Q107, which in those days, like during the day, would play Howard Stern, which I didn't normally listen to, but I have such a memory of him on the radio and him having this weird real time, like looking out his window and saying like, oh my God, it's fallen. It's like, and being this sort of weird, vulnerable human that no one had heard him be. And so that was sort of my drive. And I you know, the hour and a half it takes to get there. And I'm just thinking, what am I doing? Like, I'm going to go do a play. Like it just felt meaningless, you know, the audition, going to do this show, and like, was the world ending? And you know, what was the point of it all? So drove, got there. And it's weird, because I don't, you know, we didn't have ready access to email. So I feel like Christopher Newton, the artistic director then at the Shaw Festival, I think he'd called a company meeting, but it may have just been that the company of Peter Pan met in the green room. I just remember all of us being sort of assembled there, and, you know, truest of Christopher fashion, like he just spoke calmly and clearly about what we do and the arts. And I'm not one of those people who has a Newton, you know, but I just remember him saying, you know, this is really hard and we have to go on. And I was like, no, we don't. No, we should all take the day off. Like, and he just said, like, they're here. The people that have made it are here and they want this. They need it. They need to be distracted. And what we do is extraordinary, you know, and what we offer is extraordinary. We have this capacity to help people escape. So maybe we can kind of come together to do that, to offer that. And I've been going this whole way just thinking like, this is meaningless. Like, why am I going to do this? And then here he says this thing, and everyone's like, yeah, like we can beat the terrorists with our musicals, you know? And, but there's a sense of purpose and quiet and uncertainty, and it didn't make everyone feel safe per se, but there was such comfort in his certainty. Yeah, so we did a really weird Peter Pan. Keep in mind, this is like 2001. So at that time, every show we did was like 98%. Like, I feel like it was pre-SARS. It was, and it was a completely different place. So when you come out to do like this show and there's maybe a 50% house, it's like so shocking and weird, and there are pirates and cannons and people, you can feel them sort of flinching, but we got through it. But the thing that was remarkable for me, and I think a lot of the company that I worked with, was that evening we're doing a show called The Mystery of Edwin Drood. Hey, you are. Which is a musical, is a very silly musical by Rupert Holmes. He of Pina Colada fame. If you like Pina Coladas, get caught in the rain. Which he came to opening and we made Pina Coladas and he was like, that's terrific. No one's ever done that. I don't like Pina Coladas, nor the rain or any sort of precipitation. So we went to do this show, and this one was, it was set in like a music hall. So we were all sort of very meta-theatrically playing the performers in the show. And so pre-show, we had to run out and go to the audience and be like, hello, hello, how you doing, mate? You want to have a good time tonight, you know? And just like putting your arms around the ladies and saying, wah, 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 you know? And just grotesque and sometimes very fun, sometimes very painful. But I remember getting there and just being like, I think it was Alan Teichman was our stage manager, and saying like, Alan, like, no, we can't do that. Like, we can't go out. We can't pretend. And he just said, just go out and be with the people however you think that is. Don't feel you have to put on a big silly character. And it was just like, oh, this is the worst. But we did. I think we pulled back our accents a bit, you know. Still a little British, but, you know, like sitting next to a person in this half-empty theater, again, almost never the case at the George, saying, you know, how you doing tonight? You know, we're going to have a good time. And they're just like, yeah, you know. And we started to form these, like, weird bonds with these people in the audience. We all, like, kind of agreed we're going to do it. So we did it, and it's like a big, you know, grown, as close to a panto as I've ever done. Big, broad, silly show. And people were laughing. Like, the Peter Pan was weird. People weren't reacting. But people kind of surrendered to it. And there were a lot of opportunities in the show to kind of connect with the audience. Hey, everyone having fun. And people kind of bought into it. I mean, I remember forgetting that it had happened, you know? And then near the end of the show, there's this song called The Writing on the Wall, and Blythe Wilson, extraordinary Blythe Wilson, was playing Edwin Drood, and she's singing this song, and as she's singing it, her voice is cutting out, which like never ever happens with her, you know. She's like such a pro, and she's, I'm like, is she choking on something? She got some carrots in her throat, you know, like what's going on, Blythe? That's not like you. And then I suddenly realize what she's singing. I don't really remember the song, it was quite a while ago, but you know, the lyrics are, is it clear? If you hear my voice, then you're alive. What a bloody marvel we survive. When you think of everything we face in this mad human race, I have seen the writing on the wall. And it's something like fairly spelled out for all who've held out. And it's just like, she's supposed to sing the whole song, and the very end we come in with this like final line. Then suddenly everyone starts to realize what's happening. Oh my God, like the enormity of this song is too much. The words are so resonant. So we start sort of trying to sing along with her, but we're all crying and everyone's like, there was kind of got their breath support. We all know how important that is. So we're all singing and it's ugly. The harmonies are gone. People are gasping, you know. Blythe kind of looks back and we all start singing together, and we get to the end, and it's this big wall of sound. And I just remember weeping. Like I said, I haven't told the story in a long time. I'm feeling a little verklempt right now, because it was just, and the audience just was like so appreciative, and I was so appreciative of just like just having that confirmed. Like, this is, I don't know if it's important, but it's meaningful. You know, it's meaningful to me standing on this weird catwalk at this moment. It's meaningful to these people who for like 2.5 hours at least at Shaw at that time got to think about something else. That was a pretty extraordinary day. And I, of course, did not book The Lion King. You know, history has proven that that did not come to fruition. And I'm willing to blame it all on 9/11.
Can I ask you to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Tim Campbell, and I am an actor in Canada, and I've spent 12 or 13 seasons at the Stratford Festival over the last several decades, or a bunch of other places, you know, Canadian journeyman stuff. So September 2011, I was at the Stratford Festival, part of the company that was doing Henry IV Part 1, Henry IV Part 2, and Henry V, and we were really burnt out and tired, and we went away to Ellicottville, New York, which is in upstate New York. The way that things worked back then was that you had to sign out if you were going to Toronto, and if you were going further than 300 kilometers away from this festival, you had to get written permission. This was designed so that people on the one day off could, you know, zip into Toronto and back, and it was no big deal. And in those days, you had to leave a landline because cell phones were not ubiquitous. You had to leave a landline that you could be reached at. But the distance between Stratford, Ontario, and Ellicottville, New York is 290 kilometers. So we just signed out. We didn't get permission because there was no stipulation about, well, you can't leave the country and you can't leave the province. And we just didn't think that that was an important thing. So we go down.
Is their fault.
It's entirely a bureaucratic hole. It's not our fault at all. So we went away to, okay, Graham Abbey's mom's husband, a great guy named Fred, had a chalet there. And so about six of us go away for a great golf and beery weekend, and we're driving back, and we're leaving Ellicottville roughly 9 a.m. because we needed to make it back to Stratford for an afternoon put-in rehearsal for Barry McGregor, who was going to be at some point further down the road replacing the great and late now Douglas Campbell, who was playing Falstaff. So we needed to be back in Stratford for the afternoon. We stopped for gas, and Tom Marriott, who was one of the actors who was down there with us, he says, turn on your radio, turn on your radio, turn on. And on every station, it was a CBS feed, and it was Dan Rather, and they were describing this horrible accident that had just taken place, and a plane had accidentally smashed into one of the Twin Towers. Mm-hmm. And as we were listening, the second plane hit. So at roughly the same moment that Dan Rather puts it together, we put it together that, oh, this is not an accident. This is not good. And we are a long way from home. Mm-hmm. And so we start driving back immediately after we figure out that out, and driving well above the speed limit. But as we're driving back, we realize that in this group of us that had gone away, sort of without permission, we had Graham Abbey, who was playing Prince Hal. And we also had Rob Hamilton, who was understudying Prince Hal. And had Tom Marriott, who was playing Sir Walter Blunt. And we had me, who was understudying Sir Walter Blunt. And it becomes really evident that if we don't get back, they're going to cancel the show. And at this point, we haven't calculated the awful human cost. We don't really know, like, the war that's going to ensue. All we know is that we are a bunch of 20-something kids in a tremendous amount of shit, and we have to get back across the border. Graham had a cell phone. He was an early adopter of the technology. So it was like our one beacon back, and we were on the phone with the production stage manager, who in those days was a man named Andrew North, and he did not have any bit of a sense of concern for our well-being. It was just get the hell home, get across the border as quickly as you can so we don't have to cancel the show and fire all of you. We are driving back, and during this drive back, we hear that a plane has then crashed into the Pentagon. Then we hear that the first tower has collapsed, and we're completely panicked, and we hear the second tower goes down, and that's about 10:30 in the morning. and we're still half an hour from the border, and we drive and drive and drive like hell, and we get to the border, and that, and the border guard was, if we looked like unsuspicious Canadian citizens just trying to get home, he was whipping people through the border. And it's obvious because we got across at roughly 11:04, and we got across the border and we're into Canada, and 7 or 8 OPP cruisers traveling at 150 kilometers an hour blow by us in the other direction to go and shut the border down at 11:07. So that is the first obstacle, that, and we were just incredibly relieved. They didn't cancel the rehearsal or anything, so we got back and we were doing this kind of pointless rehearsal in the afternoon. But that evening we had a show, and Douglas Campbell, who I adored both as a man and as an actor, gave a really, really moving curtain speech before the show. And the play, we were doing Henry IV Part One. The play's, you know, there's a lot of it that's about war. And he himself had been a conscientious objector in the Second World War, and he had very, very strong political opinions about things. But he gave an incredibly impassioned speech about the importance of making art in times of strife. And I don't know that I've ever felt more inspired to put on a play in my life. And at that point, in those days, you know, the Canadian dollar was trading at about 60 cents. So the composition of the audience was hugely American in those days,
right?
40%. So there were a bunch of Americans who were there and who were trapped in the country. So part of Douglas's speech was also, you're welcome, you're safe here with us, and we're going to tell you a story.
Amazing. He was a great guy. Oh my gosh. What a man. That's the show. My thanks to Tim Campbell and to Mark McGrinder, who, when he told me his story, made me think that this podcast idea might be a viable one. The show is produced by Kevin Sexton, and music is by Deb Sinha. Next week, the penultimate episode for the season. And next week is devoted to stage management. Stage managers have seen some shit. See you then.